Hey there, in this episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, we have lightsabers, snappy dragons, storage wars, and a Titan V for Victorious. Welcome back, everybody, to Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, the show where two of us are full-on geek and everybody at least has at least one or two screws loose. I'm Dave Altavilla for Hot Hardware, and I am with my compatriots, the illustrious Marco Cipetta and the incomparable Paul Lilly. Illustrious and incomparable. I'm teeing you guys up pretty good. How you guys doing?
Doing good. I don't think I can live up to the intro, though.
I can't remember. Were you illustrious or incomparable? I'm not sure which I called you.
Incorrigible is probably the better word.
Incorrigible. That would be me, too. Yeah. Paul, are you in something or other?
I can't remember all the ones you threw out there. If you threw out handsome, I'll take that one.
No, but then he'd be lying, Paul.
No, not with that Billy Goat.
And so it's Billy begun. Going on, man. Shots fired.
Well, it's okay. Yeah, shots fired already. Well, hey, it's good to be back with y'all again. We are back for a second consecutive week. This is a streak, gentlemen. I don't know, but we aim to be here at 4 o'clock on Wednesdays weekly. Talking all things tech, the headlines, the feature reviews at hothardware.com, and things that hopefully are important to the geek crowd out there in the tech scene. Let's dive right in. Lots going on these days as we ramp up to CES 2018, never a dull moment. And we're losing sleep at a blinding pace. Marco's been checking out some new GPUs from the folks at NVIDIA. We teased that little puppy or big puppy, Titanic puppy, last show. But Marco, you got a little bit more quality time with NVIDIA's Titan V. What can you tell us about that bad boy that costs only 3,000 smackaroos?
So we can finally tell you everything. Last week, I just basically held up the card, spit out some specs, talked about some of the preliminary numbers, which were obviously pretty awesome because the card is ultra powerful. We have since published the full article. I tested not only gaming, it's not a gaming card. I know people are going to jump right on us saying $3,000, it's not worth it for gaming. Yes, maybe not. But because it's NVIDIA's latest architecture, I'm sure tons of our readers were interested to see what it could do. So I have a full array of gaming benchmarks at 1440p and 4K, plus an array of GPU benchmarks that show some of the compute potential of the card. I say some because none of the tools I had available at the time would stress the tensor cores inside the Volta GPU. It was really just using the floating point processors inside it. With that said, the thing is an absolute complete and total monster. Just to give some quick examples, I strongly suggest coming by hothardware.com and checking out the full review. There are multiple pages of benchmarks, many, many numbers in both gaming and GPU. But just to give you some ideas, like in a general matrix multiply operation or in a n-body simulation, you know, some GPU compute type stuff, it is many times faster than a Titan XP. Not percentages, I'm talking times, like 10, 11x the performance of a Titan XP or a Vega 64. And again, this isn't even leveraging the tensor cores. This is with the floating point processors in the unit. It basically swept every single GPU compute benchmark by a wide margin, except for like a basic image processing test, which is not really whacking all of the cores. It was just something available, so I ran it. Vega 64 pulled in the lead in image processing, but it was still just a massive lead for the Titan V across the board. Luxmark, all of the GPU compute benchmarks, and in GPU mining, it's also a complete monster. Just out of the box, no tweaking, 69 mega hashes a second with slight tweaks. All I did was turn up the power and temp targets and crank up the memory clock, and I broke 82 mega hashes a second. And as far as I know, no one else has posted a faster score mining with this card as of yet. So that is just an insane benchmark there. And if you look at the gaming stuff, literally a clean sweep across the board at 4K, beat every single card, sometimes by a wide margin. loses a couple tests at 1440p, I think mostly because of driver optimizations and perhaps CPU limitations, but just a monster of a card across the board.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take a step back real quick on it. Titan V for Volta. This is an interesting product, obviously, because it's NVIDIA's next generation GPU. Is it 12 gigabytes of HBM2, right, on board? Yes. Is this a foreshadow of what we can expect down the line for consumer-based GeForce cards based on Volta? Or is it really that much further removed as a deep learning and machine learning card?
I don't think it foreshadows in the short term. Just to give an example of the previous gen, the GP, I guess it was GP102, first showed up on Quadros and Tesla cards way before the GP104 that arrived in the GTX 1080. You know, the 1080 Ti came way later after the whole mainstream lineup was fleshed out. I'm guessing, I have no indication from NVIDIA, I'm going to assume that the first batch of consumer-targeted Volta-based cards are going to follow a similar trend. We'll see a mainstream enthusiast part that's not based on this massive GPU with HBM2. We'll probably see a smaller, a GV104 class GPU linked to some sort of faster graphics memory, maybe GDDR5X, maybe something newer, not quite sure yet. And then the lower end cards will get fleshed out. And then as soon as AMD starts hinting at something new, NVIDIA will come in with something crushing based on GV100.
Yeah,
they're firing on all cylinders. Like, I mean, Pascal's almost 2 years old. They can, they have stuff in the wings getting tweaked and tuned. So.
Right. And it makes you wonder what it will be comprised of. Will we see next generation GDDR 5X or 6 memory, be coupled with that? It'll be interesting to see what that, incarnation looks like, based on that architecture or a similar architecture. You mentioned not exercising the tensor cores. Actually, I'm not sure, but I think on one of the tests in Sandra, one of the tests where, remember the bar, and I would have to look at which one it was, you probably know better than I do offhand, where the bars were like way off the hook. I think that one actually, it does exercise the tensor cores on that one Sandra test.
It doesn't on Windows. So the GEM, the general matrix multiply test in Sandra, when you run it on Windows, it's not using the tensor cores. There is a workload we're looking at for Linux that would use the tensor cores and show the potentially approaching that 110 teraflops reported number, have not worked through that yet. So we will see if we're able to pull that off.
But it was like orders of magnitude faster, like 10X or something like that.
Yeah.
Or more.
Yep.
Faster in that test.
Yeah. So the Titan XP doesn't have the FP64 cores available to it. The original Titan had those cores available. Then NVIDIA kind of disabled it in the Titan X cards. But in this Titan V, you basically have the full GV100, just like what's in the Tesla card, minus one stack of HBM2.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Paul, what do you think about this? Are you jonesing for a Titan of some sort?
I don't want to pay for one, but yeah, sure. If someone wants a gift, I'll take it. I think the mining performance is interesting, though, because I kind of hope that the consumer cards won't be as good, just because it's, the miners flock to these things, and then we're waiting on inventory and pricing to come down. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
If I were to guess, it's not going to be, the first consumer cards aren't going to come close to this. I'm totally guessing. I could be completely wrong, but I don't think they're going to use HBM2 for some sort of, huge selling, more mainstream card. And the mining is hugely tied to memory bandwidth and latency, which that super wide bus on HBM2, it's 3072 bits wide with the HBM2. If it's some form of GDDR memory on the mainstream card, it's going to be a 256 bit to max, maybe a 512 bit interface, and it will behave very differently, even with a similar number of cores, if there is a similar number of cores in the GPU. So if I was a betting man, it's not going to come close to Titan V, the first cards in mining performance.
Interesting, though. I mean, when you look at it, when you look at the numbers, mining Ethereum it's almost 2x. It's actually, it is 2x at, you know, north of 80 mega hashes a second versus like the fastest, that was Titan XP, I think you, or was it 1080 Ti that was like 37 mega hashes a second? I forget which one it was.
The Titan XP and the Vega 64 are both in the 37 mega hashes a second range.
Yeah,
so this thing does. It basically doubles both of those cards.
Yeah, that's pretty huge, and the miners are probably salivating. And I wonder what the value proposition is in its current form. So you spend $3,000 on this card. It's obviously, you know, power efficient, you know, at that, you know, if it's not consuming exorbitant more power, which I don't think it was, it's obviously power efficient at that hash rate, you know, could make up some dollars in the back end for you over time, right?
I think it would take a little over a year to pay for itself at the current rates, assuming difficulty hashing doesn't go through the roof. It's definitely not a good mining value prop at $3,000. You can stack together three much cheaper cards and beat this easily. But it's just an interesting look at the future. That's all. We had it. The test was available to us. We ran it.
Yeah. I guess if you're a data scientist or into machine learning and this is a valuable tool for you in its, you know, first instance that way, perhaps on the side, a little mining in the off hours might be in order. But yeah, at $3,000, you're right. It's probably better cards to look at. Pretty cool, though. Interesting stuff to come out of the blue from NVIDIA and, you know, unexpected here towards the end of the year. Are you expecting anything from the green team at CES, Marco?
I have no indication, but they are having, NVIDIA is having a very big press conference pre-CES. It's usually automotive and AI related, but NVIDIA CEO, you know, Jensen Huang typically has one of those, but wait, there's more moments where he'll pull something out of his jacket and show it off. And I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a consumer Volta card.
Yeah. Hey, Topher in the chat says, Chris in the chat says, any response back for the lack of SLI on that card, multi-GPU SLI connector?
No, but so here's the thing. SLI in its traditional sense means less and less with DX12 going forward. And also right. AMD is able to do crossfire without any sort of bridge between cards over PCI Express. So don't have an answer. I don't think it means much because it can still technically be done. You know, a multi-GPU support in DX12, if it's coded in a particular game, to use multiple GPUs, you technically don't need that bridge connector. So I'm not sure what's going to happen with consumer cards. This particular one, I don't have an answer.
Okay. All right, well, we'll have to stay tuned on that front and stay close to all things NVIDIA as we roll into CES, because who knows what they'll have to bestow upon us at that time frame. Interesting stuff. Thanks for taking the hours to dig into that bad boy, Marco. That was a whirlwind review.
If people knew how quickly that article came together with a trip into Manhattan in the middle, Dave and I had an event to attend in Manhattan. With a Manhattan trip in the middle, it was definitely a whirlwind.
Sleep is overrated, right?
Exactly.
All right, so let's move on real quick, and want to bring to everybody's attention a review we have up, actually, that's interesting. Totally different end of the spectrum here, involving AR, and we checked out Lenovo's Star Wars Jedi Challenges, which is a kit of sorts for gamers, and it comprises an AR headset, a Mirage AR headset by Lenovo, and that little beacon there you can see on the screen right now, it's a little, almost looks like an Epcot Center ball, if you will, that lights up. You put that in the middle of the room, you get your lightsaber, you slap any one of the compatible phones that are compatible with the system into the Mirage AR headset, and within minutes, you can be dueling Darth Vader, you know, any of the Star Wars baddies in your very own living room. And it's pretty cool. Interesting product for sure. We checked it out and gave it the full review lowdown at hothardware.com. So make sure you stop by and check that out. I think it's an interesting implementation of AR. You know, we've seen certainly the Tango, if you will, platform implementation of AR for what Google has on the Android platform. This is also in Android or actually Android or iOS app. It's compatible with iPhone 6, 7, and 8, as well as devices like Samsung's Galaxy S8, S7, S6, and I believe Moto Z and a few other ones, Pixel and Pixel 2 devices. And so there's a few of the swath of the very popular Android and iOS handsets on the market. But it uses a different technology. You have that beacon in the middle of the of your environment. You have like a 4.5 by 10 foot environment that's required, to play this game. So you want to have some space in whatever room you're doing this. And it is AR. It's not VR. So you can look through the visor, see your environment around you and the characters that you're battling in this, you know, with your lightsaber. You have a handheld, what our editor Shane had mentioned was collectible quality handheld lightsaber. Then go about, you know, battling the holograms with this lightsaber as your controller. And so it's pretty interesting. It was a heck of a lot of fun. I think, that's sort of what's impressive about this whole thing is it comes together in a very fun game that's replayable, that's fun for the whole family. It'd be great maybe if you could slap on a couple of headsets and duel together, but it's a one-person only setup right now. I think it shows promise for AR, and I think it's interesting in terms of, the implementation, which is different than what we've seen, and creates a more of a room scale AR experience, with some really good fidelity as well. There's a few little gotchas with it. You know, some of the tethering with the handset to the headset was a little tricky in spots. And there's some cables there that's not quite as convenient as slapping an Android phone into, for example, a Google Daydream headset, which we've seen before. Those are real easy to just jump right in. This is a little bit more complex to set up, but impressive nonetheless, and something that I think is sort of a sign of things to come and what could be potentially some really fun applications and gaming and use cases for AR. Wow, what are you guys' thoughts on this thing? Did you get a chance to look at it a little bit?
I did. I thought it's pretty cool. If you look at some of like the stickers available on the Pixel XL, like the Star Wars stickers, the quality of those AR characters that are getting placed in the environment are pretty darn good. That's basically what this is doing. And with that tracking beacon and the way it sort of syncs with the lightsaber, you can interact with those things and have, you know, lightsaber battles and duels with those characters. Also has that cool Holo Chess module built in too. So I didn't actually get to play it firsthand, but it's a very, very cool first implementation of something that the timing is perfect with the Last Jedi just coming out last week.
Yeah. We rolled out the review with the intro of the next gen movie. And, so it was good timing for us, I guess. But it is interesting. And what do you think about, and Paul, maybe you could give us your opinions on this as well. What do you think about AR versus VR? There's one thing that it's nice with AR is because you have, you know, the environment around you that still exists, you know, your home or whatever you're playing in, you don't get that sense of disorientation and maybe as much of a chance to have motion sickness or what have you. As a result of that, you have an orientation about you that's fixed in reality. And then obviously the augmentation takes place in front of you in these nice holograms. I think, you know, there from a consumer perspective, you know, mainstream consumer perspective, there may be more potential opportunity. And we've certainly seen Microsoft sign up for this with its mixed reality push with Windows. I think there may be even more of an opportunity with AR versus VR. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're going after. Because I think, wasn't it Tim Cook that said he sees the future in AR more so than VR? I think it's a little early, though, to to really have an opinion one way or the other, because the ones, the implementations we've seen so far, to me anyway, they feel a little bit gimmicky, like with the Zenfone AR from Asus. It worked. I mean, the AR worked, but it didn't work super well. And I think you see that kind of across the board. That's going to change a little bit with Microsoft and its partners pushing mixed reality handsets. We're going to start to see more of these. But I think as far as right now, I have a bigger interest in VR, like with the Rift and the Vive versus AR. But, you know, a year from now or 2 years from now, that could change depending on, you know, where the hardware is at and what the content is like at that time.
Yeah, I think the level of immersion is definitely better with VR, and certainly the horsepower behind it, where you've got PCs powering the VR experience through a wired tethered headset. That's a whole different level of horsepower. But Marco, what are your thoughts about AR versus VR? Is it a application or use case specific sort of thing, or does one sort of seem to have better promise than the other, in your opinion?
I think it's too divergent set of products, even though, you know, there's inevitable comparisons because there's visors and, you know, headsets involved with both. They kind of achieve two very different things. You know, for AR, you can have something much lighter weight, you know, like a Google Glasses type product, where just walking down the street, you could have augmented reality with just information. It doesn't have to be something deep and immersive like a game. Whereas in VR, you know, there are some games that would utilize the cameras on some of the headsets and sort of project your environment into VR, but you're either in VR or you're out. Whereas with AR, you're interacting with your current environment. So it's two totally different use cases. I don't necessarily think they compete. In the short term, much better experiences, I think, will be offered through AR, because it just requires less horsepower and you can do cool stuff, like even with a smartphone.
Right.
Whereas for good VR, you need some serious horsepower and high resolutions. And even these first gen products, as cool as the Rift and the Vive are, as soon as you use one long term, you'll start itching for a second generation product that improves on some of the minor problems with them.
Right. You know, and that's interesting observation you made, Paul, with Tim Cook's commentary on AI versus VR. I think there you've got a little bit, at least, of the Apple portfolio sort of coloring his opinion on the matter. Obviously, mobile devices lend themselves better to AR, and overlaying characters in an existing environment takes a little less horsepower as a wireless setup. So yeah, maybe that's his motivation for that commentary, but yeah, I think it is interesting. And I think it's nice to see the evolution of AR here with a device like this from Lenovo Star Wars Jedi Challenges. Check it out if you get a chance. What's interesting to maybe consider moving forward for this is, you know, we've got a Star Wars motif here. We've got a lightsaber controller with that beacon. What else can we do with the Mirage AR headset? So you would think there will be follow-on games, maybe follow-on controllers that you could you would see coming on board here that would extend the value for this kit beyond just Star Wars and lightsabers. I think that's key. You would think the utility and the playability would be a lot better if there were other things to tack on versus just a lightsaber. So we'll have to see what Lenovo does moving forward. If they flesh out that as a family of gaming products and AR scenarios, but pretty cool stuff for sure. Let's move on to storage. And we've got a bunch of stuff going on in the storage scene. And actually, we're gonna let's talk to Paul a little bit about what he knows with what Seagate's doing these days, and then Marco, let's transition that right into your little study you did on building a personal cloud. But Paul, Seagate came out and made another sort of surprise announcement here in Q4 on a storage breakthrough that could actually make hard drives sexy again. Is that possible, Paul?
It could. I mean, we don't see a ton of development in the hard drive space as far as cool technology. We see the capacity go up and up, but Seagate kind of had an aha moment, I think, where to describe this, you have to understand how hard drives work. I mean, you have several platters in a hard drive. These days, I think you have as many as 10 of them in there, maybe more. And you have an actuator. You have actuator arms that go with read and write heads at the end that kind of sweep over these platters and read and write data. What Seagate did was install a second actuator that controls a separate set of actuator arms with read and write heads at the end, and they work independently of each other. So it's almost like, I don't want to call it like a RAID 0, but it's sort of like that, where both sets can read and write different sets of data at the same time. And so Seagate is claiming that you can double the performance without any downside, because you have, you know, the two sets going.
Yeah. John, can you bring that up? So, and then Paul, you're going to have to give us that, that audio cue again. You just did. That was good.
Yeah. Yeah. Scroll down to the anime. Yeah. It goes, that's exactly what it sounds like, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah. It can read two different sets of data at the same time. And so Seagate says it can double the performance while also increasing capacity as they continue to do. So it's, and that way they're trying to make hard drives sexy again. And they claim no downside. We're a little bit skeptical of where the pricing might land, because that could be a potential downside. But still, compared to solid state drives, I would expect this to be a lot less expensive. We'll have to wait and see, because I don't think they announced an actual product yet, but they did announce the technology.
Yeah, it's been developed and working. And yeah, if you do the math, actually, what's interesting about this is you're now talking about, if you double the performance of maybe some of the fastest high density drives out there right now, call it a couple hundred megabytes a second. If you're able to just sheer double that performance, maybe get it to 400, 500 megabytes per second. Now you're actually talking about a product that pushes the boundary of the SATA 3 interface, right? You know, gets up to saturating that SATA interface and makes hard drives about as fast theoretically as a SATA SSD. Marco, is that possible? Do you think in reality that could be what happens?
Well, about as fast for transfers, but nowhere near as fast in terms of access times. And it's those access times that kind of, you know, fuel the responsiveness that you get with an SSD. And I know they're claiming no downsides. I guess maybe you don't necessarily double your chances of something breaking if the actuators are if there's two sets, because if one of them goes, the drive's dead anyway. But if you have RAID 0, you sort of have double the chances of failure. And if that's sort of like internal RAID 0, I guess technically it would be more prone to failure, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. There's obviously, you would think, cost incurrence with this, and then potentially, as you noted, additional mechanical point of failure. But interesting technology for sure. Nice to see that hard drives. I think what folks might not consider these days, if you're solely focused on client storage, you know, my notebook or my PC hard drive or storage subsystem, you might think that the hard drive is dead, everybody's gone SSD, but in the data center, this is huge, because bulk storage, you know, has to be cheap, and you know, hard drives are very much the mainstay in the data center for a lot of applications, certainly archival and you know, data backup, you know, sort of big volume kind of stuff, bulk storage. And so this really, you know, it speeds that up. It, you know, you could add density as a result of this, as Paul mentioned. And so it's kind of a big deal. And this came out of the blue, and we will wait to see what products come of it, but it I guess breathed a little bit more life into the hard drive platform as we know it, right?
You almost kind of wonder why they didn't think of this before. So what's the downside that we don't know about? But, you know, one possible answer to that is, you know, before we didn't need as many platters and hard drives, but as we keep increasing capacity, they keep shoving more platters in there. So maybe, you know, that's why we're seeing it now versus, you know, a few years ago.
Right. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I think, you make a good point. Somebody else in the comments on that article actually pointed out, why didn't we see this before? You know, and there's probably a reason for that. And usually it's, you know, they had the know-how, but we didn't have the technology, you know, the the actual technology to implement it is probably part of the answer to that question. But interesting stuff for sure in the land of storage, Seagate with the dual actuator technology. Check that out at hothardware.com. Also, while you're there, if you're into storage, Marco spent some time playing with some more Seagate product, very big bodacious hard drives from Seagate and a cool little NAS from Synology, right?
Yeah, so been working at Hot Hardware for closing in on 2 decades and done a ton of just straight up reviews. So we sort of approached this article a little bit differently. I got my hands on a 12 terabyte Seagate Barracuda Pro and 4 12 terabyte Seagate Iron Wolf NAS hard drives. So the Iron Wolf drives are sort of geared for multi-drive arrays in servers. So I have some straight up comparisons that show the performance of these drives. They are super fast for hard drives. You know, they're approaching, you know, they're greater than 200 megabytes a second with some of the lowest access times we've seen from hard drives. Now, the numbers don't compare to even a basic SSD in terms of transfer speeds or access times, but compared to other hard drives, they are fast. And as Dave mentioned, it's important because you can get these super high capacities for relatively low cost. A 12 terabyte SSD would be crazy enterprise class, many thousands of dollars. A 12 terabyte Iron Wolf drive is about $400. So, you know, less than a nickel per gigabyte. So it's $400 isn't cheap, but on a cost per gigabyte scale, it's cheap. So really nice hard drives, but when you use them for their intended application, you get some really massive storage potential that can add tons of convenience to your life. You know, I saw a great t-shirt that said, there's no such thing as the cloud. It's just someone else's computer, right? I love that. It's because that's really what it is. You know, everyone talks about cloud storage. You're just sending your data for someone else to manage. If you want to manage your own cloud, you need a bunch of storage space with some reliability, some redundancy, and you need to be able to access it from anywhere. And using something like the Synology DS918 Plus, the DiskStation 918 Plus that I used in this article, sort of does that for you. So I slapped the 4 Iron Wolf drives in there, configured a RAID 5 array. When all is said and done, I had usable space of over about 32 terabytes. And not only could all my machines on the network use it, but I can access it remotely as well using Synology's mobile apps or just using Dynamic DNS and connecting to my internal network. So I basically have my own personal cloud with a ton of storage space, and it's much easier to configure than you'd think. Now, my particular setup maybe doesn't hit the sweet spot in terms of cost and redundancy and ease of long-term use, but the process is the same whether you go with cheaper, smaller drives and more bays in a NAS device. You can sort of follow the same template and get all of the same benefits. I hope you come by the site and check out the article. It's interesting stuff.
Yeah. So let me ask you, and I think what folks might be wondering when you talk about, you know, building and, you know, designing and building your own personal cloud, And you talk about access to it from anywhere, any device. I think people traditionally think of, you know, small office, home office, NAS, traditionally think of it as local storage that, you know, when you're on the local network, you have access to it. And you know, that's the way they think of a NAS device traditionally for the mainstream consumer and small business consumer. But you talk about your own personal cloud and that connotates, obviously, you know, having remote access that's unfettered from any device, easy. Is it easy to set that up? And I think that's one of the things that personally I haven't delved into enough is it easy to set that up such that, you know, I'm on my Android phone, I take a picture, I shoot a video, and now I can, as long as I've got a good connection, I can auto stream that sucker to my NAS back at the ranch for storage and or my pictures in a repository. Is that seamless now? Are the apps there enough that you can do that?
Yes and no. So there is a hard way. The hard way is doing it all manually, opening ports in your router, setting up dynamic DNS. So, you know, if you have a dynamic IP with your ISP and your IP changes, you can still access everything. setting up the share and the permissions, blah, blah, blah. That's the hard way to do it, which you can still do if you're a nerd and you want to do it yourself. But something right. Synology does that makes it much easier. When you're first initially setting up this this server, it gives you, Synology gives you an option to set up something called Quick Connect. So you basically set up an account on Quick Connect and you don't have to open ports in your router. It basically sets up dynamic DNS and tunneling for you. And if you download the Synology apps on your mobile devices, you put in your Quick Connect account information and boom, you're connected to your stuff. So there's a little bit extra steps than say versus using Google Drive or whatever, or you know, Dropbox or iCloud. But it's really not hard at all. Somebody who's adept enough to just go through the browser setup and configure the device can do it. You don't have to be a super nerd to pull it off.
Cool. So Synology handles the handshake with their little app back at on one of their servers. Is that
with Quick Connect?
Is that how that works? Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. And we've seen that with other NAS devices as well. I think WD has like a MyCloud or something like that, right?
I believe so. I don't remember the branding. I've seen so much of it, but yes, WD does similar stuff. I mean, it's coming more and more mainstream because that's exactly the use case. The one that you mentioned is what people want to do. You know, you're on the road, your phone is full, happens all the time. You want to offload some stuff. You have this massive storage at home, might as well be able to send the stuff there.
Right. Right. And even when you're home on the local network, that's convenience there too, you would think, because you know, rather than tethering your phone to your machine, you can just push that sucker and you know, do it wirelessly and it'll go right to your network and away you go, sync right up. Interesting stuff. I have not played with that, you know, aspect of it. You know, I've always thought of my NAS and the home office as just the, you know, the local repository, but it's great that is now becoming a mainstream functionality in some of these NAS boxes. And this Synology box is a 4-bay. You did RAID 5 with it. Is with that many drives at play? I know you get capacity. Do you have performance as well?
That's actually the most interesting point that I think people forget, and it's a pain point for me. One of these hard drives is twice as fast as a gigabit Ethernet connection can support, right? So one of these drives is breaking 200 megs a second on transfers. The peak that you'll usually see on a typical home network with a gigabit connection is in the 80 to 100 megabytes a second range. So technically doing RAID 5 for extra performance is sort of pointless because the network connection can't support it. But by doing it this way, I lose the capacity of one drive. So I have 48 terabytes worth of drives in there. So the capacity of one drive is removed basically because parity data is spread across the other drives. So if there's a one drive failure, I don't lose any data. I'd have to replace that drive. The array would rebuild and I'd be okay. It's easier if you had more bays and smaller drives and more hot spares in there. But you know, there's so many different ways to configure. You can go lots of different directions. Ultimately, in my home network, I have other NAS devices. What I'm going to end up doing is having two on one side of the house, two on the other side, and they're going to sync. So I have backups, you know, basically spread across the house. And God forbid ever something happens to one side of the house, maybe the other side is saved and I don't lose any data. But there's literally like limitless number of configurations you can do.
So we're really reaching the limits of, you know, the gigabit Ethernet is now a limiting factor for small home office networking.
It's been a limiting factor for a long time. People didn't realize it. You know, if you, these routers, right, wireless routers with 802.11 AC, you see, you know, an AC 3000 setup. Yeah, maybe internally with the wireless connection, but from that router, you have a gigabit connection back to all your stuff. You get wireless that's technically capable of faster transfers than gigabit. Gigabit is a super reliable, very transparent, but old technology. And if you come to the site, a few months back, I was actually lucky enough to be on Wall Street with a company called Aquantia that went public. And they have multi-gig support over existing Cat5 and Cat6 cabling. That technology has been available for a while, sort of in the enterprise space and in the data center. But I don't think people realize how much they need it or will want it at home until you experience sort of, you have this $2,000 multi-terabyte storage setup and you can only move files across it at 100 megs a second across your network. I mean, you can do teaming and increased performance, but most people, without doing any crazy network configuration,
right,
you're really going to max out around 100 megs a second. And that's a shame, because you can have, you know, 5 gigabit or even 10 gigabit if your house was wired properly and get many times the performance, but you need that technology in your switch, in your PC, and in your NAS box. And it's coming. It's just not here yet. I can't wait till it comes, because it's going to speed up the network considerably.
Yeah. When you talk about things like 4K and even higher resolution video, file sizes are going to get large, much larger, and you know, streaming is going to get much more bandwidth intensive as a result of that. So yeah, you can see the need for sure. And good plug for the folks at Aquantia there. That's great, great looking technology. Promising new IPO on the NYSE or the NASDAQ that came out? It was NYSE, right?
Yeah, the New York
Stock Exchange. Yeah, the New York Stock Exchange. Yeah. I do have a burning question, and Paul, maybe you're wondering this as well. Marco, what on God's green earth do you put on a 32 terabyte NAS?
You know, you're gonna laugh.
I have some suspicions, but I'll let Marco answer for himself.
There may be some movies involved, but what's actually been bothering me is I have a 7-bay NAS. I literally have every benchmark, every article, everything that I've produced in since I got that NAS set up, plus lots of personal pictures and all that stuff. And I have it set up with 2-drive redundancy. So yeah, if something dies in there, if a drive dies, I'm not going to lose data right away. But that machine's getting old. I've had the thing set up for years. I think it's like a decade old at this point. So I want to back that up. And then I have another NAS that, I don't know, it may have a few movies on it that I want to back up as well. And I have another one with lots of kid stuff on it. And I'm like, you know what? I have too much stuff going on here. I need to have another massive storage volume. I need to spread some of this around. And having something big like this, it sort of came along at the perfect time, because now I can reconfigure things and get things spread out and have more redundancy and worry less about losing some important stuff.
Yeah.
Or losing some completely useless stuff that I'll never touch again, but I'm too much of a hoarder to delete.
Well, you know, you make a good point there. And I think people in this day and age take their data for granted. You know, their data assets, they take them for granted. And there's almost like, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, what do you guys think about this? I think there's almost this sort of expected loss at some point. So there's a tolerable level of loss that people sort of expect. Oh, you know, I put a bunch of pictures on my phone. I took a bunch of nice pictures, captured the moment of my family, my friends, and that device is going to fill up someday, and I may or may not have backed it up, and I might lose something. And, you know, it's a little bit more casual. And I think what's interesting now is that, you know, you don't have to tolerate that. And if you're careful and you set things up like you do, Marco, I think you're a power user and you've got that set up, you really can capture all of life's moments and, you know, all of your digital assets and keep them safe, keep them archived, and not have to tolerate any loss if you do it right. You know, I mean,
yeah, I mean, it takes some work and takes some managing. And I also think people are, because social media, we share so much stuff, people are less apt to worry about losing photos, because the really cool ones, they probably share it on Facebook or, you know, Instagram or whatever, and they're online. It might not be the best quality, but they're not going to be completely without it, you know, unless there's some sort of global catastrophe that knocks out social media. So yeah, there is more nonchalance about keeping data safe because lots of it is online. But I don't know, I put so much work into organizing so much of this data that I would hate to lose any of it. So I'm just sort of remapping out my personal backup scheme in my network.
Yeah.
I think the other thing too is data backup is not exactly glamorous or sexy. I mean, it's not like buying a game where you can have an immediate benefit where you're playing it. You invest in a NAS box and the hard drives, and you put your stuff over there as a backup, and then what? I mean, you're done. I think where you really realize it, though, is when something happens where you lose your data, and then you're like, oops, I should have had that backed up. Yeah, exactly. So that's a mistake you usually make once, and then it becomes glamorous. But until then, you know, it's easy to take that.
I mean, if you're a super nerd like me, it's really glamorous to have a mapped network drive that says, you know, 36 terabytes free on it. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. You have to be total.
As excited.
You'd have to be one of the full geek in the 2.5 geek set. No question about it. exactly. But actually, you know, I had a bit of a, you know, a gotcha there recently where, you know, I have a RAID 1 array in my workstation where I store all of Hot Hardware's videos. And, you know, we upload them to YouTube, you know, whether it be our reviews or even our podcasts like this. Mostly reviews and on scene footage, you know, of trade shows and whatnot. I keep on this RAID 1 array. Well, something went crazy. The RAID split, you know, on a BIOS update or something with the motherboard. And I ended up, when I rebuilt the array, I had a bunch of files that got corrupted, a bunch of video files that got corrupted. So now I'm reliant, no disrespect, on YouTube to pull down the original source. It may not be 100% full resolution of what I had after transcoded to YouTube. And I wish I did it differently. Even a RAID 1 array really wasn't redundant enough. I should have had two locations, right? Two storage spots, maybe the RAID 1 in my workstation and one of my NAS as well. So shame on me. Right. But yeah, you can never be too careful.
And just to add another wrinkle, I help out some friends that have, you know, small businesses and stuff, and a couple have been hit by ransomware. And some of the more advanced ransomware will crawl your network and will hit your mapped volumes or open volumes on the network as well. So ideally, if you really want to be super protective of your data, you want to back up your personal rig to a server and that server to the cloud or some other offsite location. Where it's not accessible to something that invades your local network easily, you know. So lots to think about. There's just so many ways to go. Storage is not sexy, but it can get complex. It's really interesting stuff.
Yeah. Backup early and often in multiple places. That's kind of the rule of thumb, right? Yeah. And you always, I mean, Marco, you've probably, you know, had data loss at some point. So, I mean, you know, everybody seems to get bitten somewhere along the way, but, you know, best laid plans. So, all right, let's move on and we'll wrap up the show on a mobile note. Interesting data point came out today on Qualcomm's next generation Snapdragon 845, which was seen in Geekbench scores. Was it Geekbench? Yeah, I think it was Geekbench. And it broke cover in a next generation Galaxy device, which we believe to be Samsung's Galaxy S9. And Paul, you wrote that one up. Why don't you dive in real quick on that and then we'll roundtable it. But interesting performance numbers from the new Snapdragon 845, which is yet to be released fully on the market, but was announced by Qualcomm just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, so in the single core test in Geekbench, this was the first device by Samsung to cross the 2,000 point threshold. I think it scored, let me look on there, 2,422. And in the multi-core test, it was also a new high for a Samsung device. It scored over 8,000, which that one is well above anything we've ever tested in-house. The next closest was the Moto Z2 Force, which scored 6,643 points in the multi-core test. Yeah. So it's a fast phone. It doesn't catch up with the scores of the iPhone X and the iPhone 8, which I think they both score over 10,000 in the multi-core test. But on its own, it's right up there. And it's, like I said, it's the fastest Samsung has had, and it's the fastest. If we would have benched it, which we didn't, if we would have benched it, it would have been the fastest we've laid our hands on so far.
Yeah, in terms of Android phones, you're right. It's significantly faster single core performance, and what looks like, geez, I'd have to do the math real quick, but you know, another 2,000 points in Geekbench in multi core. So 8,300 versus 6,600 is the fastest Android handset we've tested. Impressive gains to be sure for the Snapdragon 845. When you think about Snapdragon 835 phones now, devices like Samsung's Galaxy S8, S8 Plus, I have an LG V30, which I love, feels snappy as all get out. Google's Pixel 2. These are all Snapdragon 835 powered Android flagship phones that do very well. They have great cameras, great performance. But as you noted, don't catch, you know, certainly don't catch the iPhone 10 and, you know, Apple's, was it the A10 processor there, right? They don't catch that. And the Snapdragon 845 from the scores we've seen here, at least these are preliminary. This is not a, you know, officially sanctioned test, we assume, just showed up in the Geekbench database. The 845 doesn't even catch the iPhone 10. So we did some quick numbers. We've got a, you know, an editor on staff that's got an iPhone 10. He saw a multi-core score of 10,000 and a single core score of over 4,000 with the iPhone 10. So it's very interesting to note what Apple does more with less, you know, fewer cores. I think they have a six core chip? Yeah, I think it's a six core chip, the iPhone, the A10, right? They do more with less, fewer cores. I don't know if there's an efficiency there in the OS, you know, because we're talking ARM cores, they're custom architected ARM cores. Marco, what are your thoughts there for this next generation Snapdragon chip versus what Cupertino puts together in the iPhone?
So I think that actually the A10 is a quad core. But the thing that Apple does is they customize the cores and they're tuned specifically for the iOS sort of workloads. And there's a lot more you can do when you're building the hardware specific for your software and tuning the software for hardware that you built. You know, that when you have that sort of vertical integration that Apple does, you can get much more down to the metal and extract much more performance than you can with sort of, you know, you can sort of think of Android as the Windows for mobile phones. You know, there's tons of different platforms and Android has to run on all of them. So it's going to be nearly impossible to get that kind of, you know, synergy between the hardware and software that Apple has. And when you have that, you get these sort of, not only because Apple is making some beautiful SoCs and modifying the ARM cores specific for their workloads, but you get that sort of nice performance uplift by building everything to work together.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. You're right. It is a quad core. It is interesting. What we don't know, and you know, Geekbench just gives you at least the test that we saw here just gave us a CPU result for the Snapdragon 845. So you've got a single core CPU score and a multi-core CPU score. What we don't know is what the Snapdragon 845 does in terms of its graphics performance from this test. And we have been told, you know, based on some of the numbers in the press releases from Qualcomm, that we should expect at least a 30% uptick, I believe, in GPU performance for graphics and gaming for the Snapdragon 845. But yeah, it's going to be yet another round of ever more powerful Android devices. How much horsepower do you need in a smartphone, guys? I mean, my Snapdragon 835 powered LG V30, this gem right here, which I love this phone, feels great. I always want more. I'm a geek. I always want more power. But do we need that much more power? I guess maybe when you're talking AR and you know, that kind of stuff for handsets, you do. But what other applications do we need that kind of horsepower for? I don't know.
I think that's the key, though. If we want developers to push the envelope with AR and VR, then I think we do have to keep putting out faster hardware for the stuff that's out there right now. I don't think there's much difference between, you know, this year's flagship phone versus last year's flagship phone. And one quick clarification, the A10 is the quad core, but it's the A11 Bionic that's in the
that's
iPhone
right.
10 and the iPhone, iPhone
8. That's right.
And that that's one right. is a six core.
Right. Oh, that's okay. What I thought. Yeah. Yeah. The A11 Bionic, that's the, and those are the numbers, by the way, I want to retract that. Those are the numbers that we ran in house. It was on an iPhone 10. And so it was the A11 that was under the hood for that. So that scores, again, 10,000 or so in the multi-score test and just a little bit north of 4,000 in the single-core test, which, again, if you look at the numbers, 845, the Snapdragon 845 at 2,400 versus Apple's single-core test at performance or IPC in at least this one benchmark at almost 2x that. You're thinking, oh, man, it's highly tuned. And I think, Marco, to your point, you're looking at a highly tuned, tightly coupled, you know, single platform, single device type sort of situation with Apple, and with Android, it's got to work across a multitude of different handsets and platforms, right? So exactly. A little bit of a taller stick, yeah. But yeah, you know, and shame on me for being a straight man like that. How do we need more powerful devices? Of course we do. Dang it. Of course we do. But, you know, what I want to see is what's going to be interesting to see from Snapdragon 845 is battery life. I think one of the sleepers, perhaps that, you know, some folks know about, certainly the enthusiasts that care about battery life do. The Moto Z Play, I think, family of phones, you know, with the big batteries, and they were based on Snapdragon 600 series chips that go for days and days and days, you know, on a single charge. I think, you know, we have a lot more ground to gain on battery life too as well, right?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, we do.
You can never have too much battery.
Let me point out one thing before I forget it too. As far as the performance goes and pushing for faster chips, another reason to push for that is because, remember, now we're starting to see Qualcomm Snapdragon chips in Windows 10 laptops. They have the 835 right. in there now, and then the 845 in there in 2018, and then, you know, who knows after that. So,
yeah, yeah, Marco, what were you? Oh, did you already forget it? You already have your senior moment that Paul escaped from.
Oh, no. I was just saying that you can never have too much battery life. I mean, that's going to be not only will battery technology improve, but improving the efficiency of the SoCs is not going to stop anytime soon. So, I mean, the end game is having basically all of the same compute capabilities across all of your devices. And that's a long way off.
Yeah, man. Good stuff. And Paul, you make a good point. I mean, we saw Snapdragon 835 devices, had some hands-on time at the Qualcomm Snapdragon Summit in Maui that I was fortunate enough to attend a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, those devices are capable, you know, productivity and, you know, standard sort of desktop, you know, use cases, web browsing, what have you. But a Snapdragon 845 powered Windows PCs, you know, would be that much faster and that much more robust. So yeah, that's going to be interesting to see, you know, how that gets productized when those roll out as well. You would expect that Qualcomm and the folks at Microsoft already have those, you know, in the back room testing, one would think at this point, but no word officially on that. So Marco, let's wrap this thing up. I think we're getting close to the top of the hour here, and let's give some sort of definitive word for these for folks on our next giveaway, maybe sort of kind of.
I don't have a definitive word to give. We are still hammering out the details. Dave was trying to pull it off so that we can make the announcement today. We were supposed to have a holiday giveaway in place. It's kind of too tight to pull together a holiday giveaway now. So maybe it's a post CES giveaway or pre CES giveaway. The wheels are in motion. What I can say is there will be a very large prominent OEM involved. There will be more than one prize. Just not sure what it is yet.
There you go. That's fair enough. Yeah, we are lining up giveaways. As we always do, usually there's another one coming pretty quick. We got kind of caught up in the Q4 holiday rush here. So we don't have a holiday giveaway to talk about, but within the next couple of weeks, and it'll be pretty epic. So stop by hothardware.com to check us out. And you can find us around the web at hothardware.com. Facebook.com/hothardware, Twitter.com/hothardware, YouTube.com, where you're hopefully watching us right now. Thumb this up, hit the subscribe button, please. Hot Hardware Vids. And of course, Google+, Plus Hot Hardware. Paul, where are we? Are we on ChristianMingle.com or whatever it's called too?
I have not checked. I'm just going to assume we're out there as well.
I think that was one of Marco's gems from weeks gone by. Well, anyways, yeah, thanks guys. Thanks for joining me. Thanks everybody for watching us. Parting words before we hang up the stream mic here, before we
Sure. Drop the mic. Just in case people that have watched the last couple of weeks think we're dangling this contest and aren't going to deliver, come by the site. Look at all the contests we've had. I would not be surprised if we've given away $100,000 worth of stuff in the last 5 years. We've given away tons of really cool stuff, and we make it super easy. So I promise we will have something soon. Other than that, I hope you guys enjoyed the show, and listen to Dave. Subscribe.
Thanks for stopping by, everybody. Take care.